Well, listen, today I'm actually switching things up a little bit. So if you're here on a normal basis, you know how I normally like to do things. We'll open a text and we'll sit and we'll open it. We'll kind of go through it and see what Scripture has to say. Today I want to do something a little bit differently on Easter. We're going to take a text and we're going to spend a long time reading through an account that happened in the book of John. So if you have a Bible, please turn to John chapter 9. If you don't have one and you want to borrow one on the rack in front of us, it's actually on page 80, so you can grab that and do that. So I will not have any of the Scripture on here. So if you're not reading on your device or you're not reading in your own Bible, just listen and imagine and think as I read through this account. You just kind of visualize the story as it happens. And then we're going to talk about really the reason why we're here. We're going to talk about who this Jesus Christ really is. And for some of you, you grew up going to church and you've heard people talk about Jesus. So you understand that fully. But for some of you, you might say, you know, I really don't know in my mind what I have concluded about who Jesus is. And today I'm hoping that we will give you some help at being able to conclude who he is. Now, this is going to be a little longer than the normal passage. So if you come back in the next few weeks, you know that I'm not going to do the same thing every week. But this is unique and it's Easter. So let's do this. It's in John chapter 9. And it's the story about the man who was born blind. Now, Jesus passed by. As Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, saying, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And Jesus answered, "Well, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God would be revealed in him. I must do the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work, and as long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world." And when he said these things, he spat on the ground. He made clay with the saliva and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which is translated sent. So he went and he washed and he came back seeing. Therefore the neighbors and those who previously had seen that he was blind, they said, is not this he who sat and he begged? And some said, "Well, this is he." And others said, "Well, he's like him." But he said, "I am he." And therefore, they said to him, "How were your eyes opened?" He answered and he said, "A man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to the pool of Siloam and wash.' So I went and I washed and I received my sight." Then they said to him, "Well, where is he?" He says, I don't know. They brought him who formerly was blind, because that's now his new nickname. He's not the blind man. He's the formerly blind man. He brought him to the Pharisees. Now, it was the Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. And then the Pharisees also asked him again how he'd received his sight. And he said to them, "He put clay on my eyes, and I washed, and I see." Therefore, some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath." Others said, "Well, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. They said to the blind man again, "What do you say about him? Because he opened your eyes." And he said, "Well, he's a prophet." But the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight, until they called his parents, the parents of him who received his sight. And they asked him, saying, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he see?" And his parents answered, they said, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But by what means now he sees, we don't know. Or who opened his eyes, we don't know. He's of age. Ask him. He'll speak for himself." And his parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that Jesus was the Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore his parents said, "He's of age. Ask him." So they again called to the man who was blind and said to him, "Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner." And he answered and he said, "Whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, though, I was blind, and now I see." And then they said to him again, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" They're little dense, aren't they? He answered them, "I told you already, and you didn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? And then they reviled him. And they said, you are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he came or where he's from. And the man answered and said to them, why, this is a marvelous thing that you don't know where he's from, yet he's opened my eyes. Now, we know that God doesn't hear sinners, but if anyone's a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it's been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And they answered and said to him, you were completely born in sins. And are you teaching us? And then they cast him out. And then Jesus heard that they had cast him out. And when they had found him, he said to him, do you believe in the Son of God? And he answered and he said, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? And Jesus said to him, you have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you right now. And then he said, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. So this is kind of an account of people trying to figure out, who is this Jesus? Jesus is in action. He's always doing something. He's always doing something amazing. And here he takes a man who was born blind and gives him sight. I want to talk today a little bit about Christianity. I want to do so by taking a look at really the data, the facts behind Christianity, which is really Jesus himself. You know, a number of years ago, this was back in the 70s, there was a sign on a college campus, and pastor and author Tim Keller tells this story. I heard this story from a sermon that he spoke a long time ago, and I was so affected by what he said. He had five different options. He says, there are five different options that you have about Jesus. And I thought, this is great. I just want to share what Tim said. I want to kind of share that in my own outline. But one of the things he said that he saw on this campus, he said, somebody wrote this. He said, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is intellectually credible and existentially satisfying. It's intellectually credible and existentially satisfying. These are two tests of any valid worldview system, of how you go through life. It's got to be rational. It's got to be consistent. It's got to be coherent. It's got to be true. It's got to be relevant. It's got to connect with people. It's got to connect with where I experience life in order for it to be a relevant worldview system. And we live in a day today where people no longer take time with the first statement of this, that it's intellectually credible. People kind of bypass this when they're looking for something to hold to, something to believe in. See, the important thing for them is this. Does it work? Will it make me feel good? Will it satisfy my needs? Are all the right people on board? Does it have the kind of the right buzz, the kind of mystique about it? Is it sort of politically in the right circles that I think that I want to be with? And the problem is, this is a very scary thing because it's a very dangerous approach to truth. You guys have heard of the placebo effect, right? The placebo effect is basically this. If you're sick or you're dying because of an illness, and then somebody, they give you a placebo, which is just a pill, or they basically tell you, they trick you into thinking you're getting medicine, but really you're not. It's just it's a pill with really inert matter in it. It's not going to help your body. It's not going to hurt you. But because you believe that this medicine is going to help you, what happens in your mind is actually your brain tricks you into thinking that you're getting better for a little while, that some of your symptoms are actually lessening. But in the long run, this thing is very, very deadly, because objectively it can't do anything about your disease. It can do nothing about your disease. And I believe that there is such a thing, I would call it a spiritual placebo effect, okay? So you have lots of people who believe all sorts of, I'm just going to call them placebo belief systems. It looks like it's something. It looks like it could be a valid belief system, but it contains nothing to really hold it up. It contains nothing of value. And people say, well, you know, I have joy and peace and I feel good because I belong to this belief system. And unfortunately, it doesn't really take a whole lot in order to come up with those types of feelings, right? I mean, you can be a part of a gang and you can feel like you belong, right? I mean, you could be the mafia. Oh, it's good to have an income. I've got brothers, right? What if there is a spiritual placebo effect? What if you feel good for a while in reality you're dying because your belief system, it can't internally and spiritually help you? It can do nothing for you. See, there are millions of people in the world who can say, Christianity is fulfilling and it's satisfying and it has forever changed them. But see, that's not what Christianity is based on. Christianity is intellectually competent and true. Our world tends to have the system of belief that says, you know, who cares as long as it works? Christianity says that, listen, it only ultimately works if it's true. It's got to be true in order for it to work. And if you read through the scripture, you'll never hear a call to come to Christianity because it's relevant. But I'll tell you what it is. You'll never hear a call to come to Christianity because it works. It does. Or because it's exciting, or because it's fulfilling. I think it is. It really is. But see, Jesus says, come to me because it's true. And actually, he says, come to me because I'm true. Because I'm the way, I'm the truth, and I'm the life. So this is the question I want to address with you today. I want you all to ask this question. How do you know that Christianity is true? And it starts with answering the question, who is this Jesus? Who really is Jesus? And I want to take some time and look at the main evidence behind Christianity by looking at Jesus himself as data. We're just going to look at Jesus, okay? And in John 9, we read this, and you heard it. Everybody's coming up with theories about him. Like, who is he? Where did he come from? What did he do? Why did he do this? Who is he? Where is he? Who is he? They keep asking this, and they need an explanation. And some said, well, this man's a sinner. But then they said, well, sinners can't do what this man did or speak how this man speaks. He can't be a sinner. And then you hear, oh, this man is a prophet. And then you get to the man who was born blind, who was given sight. And he falls down and he worships him. And you know what Jesus does? He receives it. What kind of a person receives worship? I mean, think about it. Who receives worship? About 50 years ago, there was an author, a religious studies author. His name is Huston Smith. And he wrote a book that's still around today about the world's great religions. And in it, he concluded that there are two prominent, influential figures that were so tremendous that what marked them in their lives was such beauty that people, they didn't just ask, who are you? But they kind of asked, what are you? Because you're different than everybody else. And he points out two people, and he says one of them was Buddha, and the other one was Jesus. And he points out that that these two individuals, the responses that they had were completely different. When people wanted to worship Buddha, he said, don't worship me, I am not a god. Don't worship me. He says this, look to my dharma, look to my doctrine. Go to with what I teach. That's what you do. What I've taught you, you go and you follow that. But I'm not a god. But Jesus, he accepted worship. He claimed to be God. When Thomas fell down and worshiped him and he said, my Lord and my God, he received it. And you know, thousands of people, they have made divinity claims. And Jesus, he made thousands and thousands of claims, and he pulled all of them off. He predicted the Jewish temple would be destroyed and not one stone would be left unturned. And it happened in 70 AD. Mark writes down, I don't have this on the screen, but Mark writes down this, that Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man, that's his own nickname for himself, he must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. And after 3 days, he would rise again. The amazing thing about Jesus is that none of his claims mattered. None of them mattered unless he rose from the grave to fulfill them and prove what he said. His argument was such a tight argument, it was such a tight package, that unless he was to raise from the grave, everything that he would have said, it would have just fallen as being totally untrue and unreliable. But once he rose from the grave, everything was all the more reliable and all the more true, and it mattered infinitely. Because he had such a tight argument of everything of who he was and about people. But it all depended on the resurrection. See, that's why we're here today worshiping. Listen, there's no thoughtful person, and I would like to assume that all of you here today are thoughtful people, meaning that you think about the details. But there's no thoughtful person who can walk away from these facts without studying it intently. And I know people, and they say, you know, well, I'm not a Christian, I grew up in church, you know, and I understand all that, but I really don't, you know, go with all that. Or maybe I took a religious class, you know, religion class when I was in college, but I decided, you know, I'm not really interested in going much deeper. And I know there are people that have done that. But listen, because of the magnitude of his impact in history, it shows us you better not just doubt thinking that Jesus is not God, okay? You better know that he isn't God before you walk away. You better know beyond a shadow of a doubt and say, oh, I'm 100% positive he isn't God before you walk away. Because think of the magnitude of his claim. He said, if you reject me, you're eternally damned. This is what Jesus said. These are huge claims. So I just want you to think of some things. So it's post-tax season. Hopefully you've all got your taxes done, right? But I just want you to imagine that before your tax season came, that you received a letter from our beloved IRS. And in the letter, it said that you owe taxes, that you owe $60,000 worth of taxes. And the first thing out of your mouth is, because you didn't even make $50,000 this year, right? Now, what are you going to do after you're angry and you tear up the letter or whatever? You know what you're going to do? Because of the magnitude of the claim, you're going to make a phone call. You're going to call them. You're going to say, there must be a problem. This is outrageous. But because of the magnitude, if it was true and you missed it, your life would be ruined. So because of the magnitude, you're going to make the call. Let me go to the other side. Let's just imagine that you receive another letter. And it's on official letterhead. It's coming from overseas, over from England. And what you read in this letter is that they have been searching through the genealogies, and they have found out that you are a long lost heir of the British throne. Mm-hmm. And some of you are thinking, well, that can't be true because I'm Chinese, you know, or whatever you're thinking. But, even so, because of the magnitude, wouldn't you just make the phone call? He said, well, let me call and find out. Is this really legit? Because it looks legit. They gave you all the right things to say. It doesn't look like it's a scam letter. With Jesus, his claim to be the way, the truth, and the life, and that nobody comes to the Father except through him, it's an enormous claim. What if he really is who he said that he is? You know, with somebody like David Koresh, you don't really have to take much time to study his life to find out that he's sort of in the league of the wingnuts. You really don't. But with Jesus Christ, you have to take the time. You need to look at the case for Jesus. There are only about five reasonable options that you have for Jesus. There are only five. And I want to give them to you today, but first what I want to do is let me just give you some facts about him. Here's some basic facts. 2,000 years ago, there was a man in Israel, and he claimed to be the Messiah. He claimed to be bringing the kingdom of God to earth. And as he went about with his message, people saw him do miracles. They saw him walk on water. They saw him feed 5,000 men with five loaves and two fish. They saw him raise people from the dead, heal the sick, give sight to the blind. Now listen, I'm not telling you that he did miracles. What I'm telling you is thousands of people saw him do what they described as miracles. This is not you listening to me. This is you looking at thousands of people who describe miracles, and it created an incredible following of the people who watched him and listened to him. It was an incredible following. And he not only claimed to be God, he convinced the people who followed him and who were closest to him and lived with him that he was God. He convinced them. Now keep in mind, the last people on earth who would ever believe that a human being could be God would be first century Jews. So in the East, people, they believe that God is in everyone, and so it wouldn't be unusual for someone to come along and say, oh, God is in me, and they'd be like, yeah, you know, everybody thinks all that stuff. And in the West, you have the Romans and you have the Greeks, and they had a plethora of gods that they worshipped, and they would often disguise themselves as humans and come down and sleep with humans and then create demigods. But with the Jews, they had a view of transcendence of God that was unmatched at any other place at that time. They held that God was the only creator. He was above the world. That he was beginningless, had no beginning. And the Jews, they had been taught for 2,000 years, never worship anything created. It doesn't matter if it's a calf or it's a cat. It doesn't matter if it's the sun or the moon. Don't worship anything that is created. And God was so holy to them that they wouldn't even utter the name of God for fear. They wouldn't speak his name. They were afraid of taking the name of the Lord their God in vain, so they just wouldn't speak it. Because he's so holy. And so the last people to believe that Jesus was God would have been the Jews. And not only that, the last people who would believe that you were God would be the people that you live with. Just think about that. The people who you live with, would you ever be able to convince them? Nah, it wouldn't happen, right? And see, this is why when you have a hero, you got a sports figure, somebody who everybody kind of looks up to, and whether it's a celebrity, whatever, and then somebody comes out with a book deal, what it was like to live with them, a brother, a wife, a husband, whatever, and they come out with this book and you read exactly what they're, and all of a sudden you kind of figure it out, and everybody knows what they were really like. And that whole status of elevation, it just comes down because look at what they were real like. Look at what they did in their off time, how they treated other people. So listen, if you were to claim to be God, would anybody in your household now or when you're growing up, would they ever believe you? Nah, they wouldn't. Yet Jesus' brothers did. Jesus' brothers, James and Jude, they both did. The apostles of Jesus, the disciples that lived with Jesus for 3 years, they did life with him, they lived with him, they ate with him, they went wherever he went for 3 years, and they believed it. See, the last people you would ever get to believe that you're God are the people that you live with and you do life with. But the group of people that surrounded Jesus not only heard his claim to be God, they believed it. And they even changed their day of worship from Saturday over to Sunday. They changed it just like that. They said, we're going to start meeting on the first day of the week. Fourth point here. After he died, hundreds of people confessed that they saw him risen from the dead. And it wasn't just the apostles. 500 people at one time were all around Jesus and they saw that he was alive. And fifthly, many of those people, they were so completely transformed that they spent the rest of their lives telling others about Jesus, even to the point of torture or even execution. And they said, this isn't just something that I believe. They said, this is not something that we believe. It's something that we've seen. We've seen him. We've heard him. We've experienced this. It's not just a belief. And they went to their death, not just for a belief, but for something that they saw and they experienced. So these are just five quick facts. How do you respond to these facts? How do you account for these five facts? Now, let me give you five options that you have, okay? The first two options, they're impossible. The second two options, they're improbable. And the last option is totally inescapable. So let me just throw these out here. And I'm going to spend most of my time on point number one. So if you're a timekeeper, you're going to be like, hey, he's been spending a lot of time. It's true, I have, I will. Here's the thing. For the very first one, most people get out from under the facts in this way. They say, well, Jesus was just a legend. This is how a modern person gets out from under Jesus and his data. They say, well, you know, how do we know who Jesus was? How do we know that he claimed to be God? How do we know that he did miracles or any of the stories? And they said, listen, let me tell you, this is what happened. Jesus was a person who was so charismatic. And all of his individual followers, they were just amazed by him and they liked him. So after he died, they weaved all sorts of tales about him. It's kind of like the game Telephone, where you whisper something in somebody's ear and it comes all the way around the room and it comes back. And it's something very much embellished. It's very different than what you originally said. And he says, they say it's kind of like that. Over time, people began to embellish the stories and put words into Jesus' mouth. And then the early church, they began to make up stories, and they wrote the New Testament, all the New Testament books, they wrote those, but it was written by biased Christians many years later. So we really have no idea really what Jesus said. We don't know what was original, what was genuine with Jesus. I mean, a lot of it's just embellished types of things. Now, that's how a modern person gets out from under the data, but let me give you three reasons why this cannot be true. Just can't be. The very first thing, the Bible was written as history, not as legend. Okay? Let me give you a quick example of this. This is Luke. Luke wrote the book of Luke and also the book of Acts in the New Testament. And Luke begins his letter this way to a friend of his. And this is what he says. He says, many have undertaken to compile a narrative about the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as the original eyewitnesses and servants of the word handed them down to us. It also seemed good to me, since I have carefully investigated everything from the very first, to write to you an orderly sequence, most honorable Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things about which you have been instructed. Luke says that he wasn't an eyewitness. So what he did is he went around and he interviewed the eyewitnesses and he compiled all of their data and he compared the various accounts so that you can be certain. This is what he says. He's writing like an investigative journalist. He's not writing legend. He's writing facts. In fact, as you read what he wrote, you know that Luke was a doctor. He was a physician. And sometimes he used terms that he would use in sort of the doctor world of his day. The medical world. So he writes this as like an investigative journalist. Matter of fact, all of the New Testament, all of the Bible, it's written as a history. It's not written as legend. Another literary critic says this. When you read the New Testament, you can tell that the Gospels are not written as legends. In one sense, they aren't good enough. In other words, if it isn't history, it would have had to be a form of prose fiction that didn't exist until the 18th century. There are little things, such as in John 8, where Jesus is writing in the dirt, where it has no significance in the story. These are the marks of its historicity. So today we read through John 9, and do you remember the part where it says the name of the pool is Siloam, which is translated sent? And you're like, what's that all about? I don't know. But it's history, it's a detail, it's written down by somebody who was there, and he says, oh, I'm going to put that detail in. It doesn't really matter to the story. It's about a man who was born blind, who gained his sight. What is the deal with this pool? And today we've got a genre in which most novels are used. It's realistic prose fiction, and it goes into detail. So it's like, when he dropped the hammer, it slid down the tin roof. And then it caught on the gutter, tumbled through the air until it landed 2 feet next to his little brother. And his brother was surprised, dropped his glass, and broke it on the ground. You don't have that kind of writing in legends. It does not exist. That's how we write fiction now. But it wasn't how they wrote fiction in the first century. They didn't put the little details in the legends of the day. Luke says it's not a legend. And he writes it as a historically accurate, investigated fact. So you don't have the option of saying it's a legend. Either you have to say, well, this is a blatant lie meant to deceive you, or they're historical accounts. One or the other. There is no legend option. You don't have it. Let me give you a second reason why. Second reason why it can't be legend is because the witnesses were still alive when it was written. If they're lies, you have to account for this issue. See, up until the 1900s, the scholars thought that the Gospels, they weren't written until about maybe 100 years after the actual accounts of Jesus and what he did. But since then, research and archaeology over the last 100 years have basically pushed it back. Now, all scholars agree that the Gospels were written before 70 AD. That means that they were written between 35 and 40 years after the actual events. And the epistles of Paul, what he wrote, they're written within 20 years after the events of things that happened. So this is very important. Because if you're going to fabricate stories like the Gospels and the epistles, what it presents to us, the only way you're going to get this to work is if you'll wait until all the witnesses are dead. So they can't contradict you. You wait till they're dead, because then nobody's going to come up with proof and evidence that you lied. So I'm 48 years old now, and in Summit County this summer, my high school, they held their 30th high school reunion, which I didn't get a chance to go to. 30 years. Okay, so that's 30 years ago when I graduate. So that's like 10 years more than how long Paul waited before he wrote the accounts of after Jesus lived and everything happened. Okay? So that's 10 years longer. Now, if I decided to write a book that 30 years ago, when I was just 18, that there was a catastrophe that happened in my area, that there was a terrible storm around the town of Dillon, and there was a tanker that was going over the Dillon Dam, and something happened, that tanker went over the edge, and it exploded on the dam, and when it exploded, it ruptured the dam, and then the lake, it basically overflowed, and it went in and it flooded the town of Silverthorne. Now, if I wrote a book that described that, you know what would happen to me? People would come out of the woodwork saying, "That didn't happen, Kyle. I was there. That never happened. What you're saying is a lie." Now, this is 30 years ago. There are still people who are alive who lived in the time right there where I lived. And they would say, "Kyle, there's no way. Everything that you're saying is a fabrication." See, there are too many people who are still alive for me to get away with a book like that where I would tell a lie like that. And there are some people who have died since that time, but still the majority of people are still alive who lived there at the time. If you want to fabricate something, you have to wait until all the witnesses are dead. All of the New Testament documents were written while witnesses were still alive. 1 Corinthians 15, Paul wrote to the church in Corinth, and he tells them, he says, "Listen, go and talk to one of the 500 witnesses who all saw Jesus at one point in time. Everybody together, they saw him. If you're doubting this, go talk to them. Most of them are still alive, although some have died." That's 20 years away, he says. You can still go talk to the witnesses. It wasn't a private letter. Paul didn't write this privately. This was a public letter. And see, if it weren't true, they could just go to the tomb and they could say, "Well, look, here's the body. Here's Jesus' body. He didn't really raise from the dead." But see, nobody did that. Nobody could do that. It was impossible. There was a problem. The tomb was empty. See, it can't be a legend. Either it's a lie or it's a historical document. Do the facts support it being a lie? No, they don't. It was written too early. But also consider this. Do people die for a hoax? No, they don't. Think about it. The disciples who gave up their lives to tell people about this, it would have had to be quite an amazing conspiracy if it weren't true. Kenneth Scott LaTourette, he's a historian at Yale, and he wrote this. "Why, among all the cults and the philosophies competing in the Greco-Roman world, did Christianity succeed and outstrip all others? Why did it succeed despite giving more severe opposition than any other? Why did it succeed though it had no influential backers in high places, but consisted mainly of the poor and slaves. How did it succeed so completely that it forced the most powerful state in history to come to terms with it and then to outlive the very empire that sought to uproot it? It's clear that at the very beginning of Christianity, there must have occurred a vast release of energy, perhaps unequaled in our history. Without it, the future course of the Christian religion is inexplicable. I guess you could say all of these people died for a lie. But put it within the historical context of what was happening. They couldn't have claimed that the tomb was empty because when they were saying it, that they couldn't say that Jesus was raised from the dead unless they actually saw him, and that those people were still alive to tell that it was true. They couldn't refer to the miracles unless they really happened. And some of the people would stand up and they would say, "Hey, I was the one who was blind. I was the one who was lame. I was a leper. Jesus healed me. I was one of the lepers. I was one of the 10. I was one of the 9 that didn't turn back." And they would claim, they would stand up and say, "Yes, it's true. Yes, it's true." They were alive. And they couldn't have said that Jesus claimed to be the Son of God unless he did. Because others heard him. It wasn't just them. You can't say Jesus was a legend. And by the way, when you read articles that are supposedly from like mainstream historians about how you can't really rely on what Jesus said, you need to know they aren't mainstream. They're very, very skeptical. They're very biased. Let me share a third reason why he's not a legend. Because if you doubt on the basis of historical evidence that Jesus said and he did all these things, if you doubt that, you also have to doubt and you have to say you can't know anything about the past. You can absolutely know nothing about the past because you have far more evidence that Jesus said and did the things that he did than you have for such things as like Caesar invading Gaul. You can't know anything about that. What you have is really one manuscript written 900 years after the supposed event. For the four Gospels, they're written 35 years afterwards, and the earliest manuscript we have is only just a few years after that. But here's the difference. See, there's a bias. There is a bias. When you study Caesar's Gallic Wars, you don't sit down and you don't say, "I wonder if this is true because it'll really change the way I have to live." You don't say that when you read about that. Doesn't matter if it's true or not. It's not going to change your life, whatever happened there. But who in the world can come to the gospel and see the account of the gospel and be objective? Really, who can do that? Nobody can. Because unlike the Gallic Wars, you're going to have to change your life tomorrow. Jesus teaches that your eternity depends on how you respond to him. You've lost control of your life if it's true. You can no longer live your life for yourself. You have to live your life for him. And see, nobody can be objective when studying this. So imagine that there's a judge. So there's a judge trying a case about a major company with fraud, accused of fraud, and that judge has major, major investments in that company. And if the company's found guilty, that judge stands to lose thousands and thousands of dollars. Now, would you be able to trust that judge if they claim to say, "Oh, I can render an objective judgment, I can do that"? And you would say, "Well, no, there's a conflict of interest. If they're found guilty, you're going to lose thousands of dollars, so you're going to weigh in with your bias onto this." But see, you and I have a much stronger bias and a much stronger conflict, a conflict of interest than the judge. See, if it's true, then you stand to lose control of your whole life. And if you know you've got a conflict of interest, you better double check every one of your doubts. Because you could just be prejudiced as you read through what Jesus has to say. It could be that you're like, "I really don't want this to be true. Because I just don't want to change how I have to live." So when you read it, you're like, and you're going to discount it. That's the way you're going to approach it. This is why some scholars are so skeptical of the historical accounts of Jesus. But they're not skeptical of other events. That's why it happens. See, he's not legend. It's impossible for Jesus to be a legend. Now, the second impossible option is this, that Jesus was a good man, that Jesus was a good teacher. No. You can never say the things and hear the things that Jesus said about himself and think that he's a good man. You just can't. people say, oh, you know, he's just a good teacher. Jesus is a good teacher. Jesus says that he's the way, the truth, and the life. He's the resurrection and the life. He says, no one can come to the Father except through him. He says, if you want to follow me, your love for your father and your mother, it should be like hatred in comparison to the love that you have for me. This is what Jesus said. If anyone wants to save his life, he'll lose it. And anyone who loses his life for my sake, he'll find it. He said, behold, all power and authority has been given to me on heaven and on earth. He says, I'm the only way to heaven, the only way to ultimate reality. If you want to follow me, you have to give me everything about you. All the things in the universe, they will bow down to me. If you follow me, they will bow down to you as well. Does that sound like a good teacher? What kind of person would say this? No good person. Either he's God or he's a liar. And he's on the level of what C.S. Lewis, he's on the level of the man who would call himself a poached egg. He's a lunatic. How do you respond to a person like this? Well, you can reject him. You can hate him. Maybe people will try to assassinate him, which they did. But none of this nonsense that he's a good man, that he's a good teacher. Either he's God with all authority, or he's a liar, or he's a lunatic. Which brings us to number 3 and 4. Here are the improbable options right here about the resurrection of Jesus. Okay, so maybe he's a liar, or maybe he's a lunatic. And we talk about them both at the same time because what you're basically saying is he fooled all of his followers. He fooled them all. None of it was true, but he got them to believe it. So first off, look at the quality of his teaching. It can't be the teaching of a madman. I mean, look at his life. Nobody has ever come up with the things that Jesus ought to have said. People are constantly astonished at his teaching, and he taught with authority. They're quoted, no man ever spoke like this man. I mean, read the account. Read what he says. You come up with better lines than Jesus. What kind of person would you have to be to make this stuff up? In fact, one person said, if it wasn't really Jesus who said this, we need to find out whoever taught this so that we can follow them. Because what he said was amazing. It was life-changing. If somebody made this up, we'd be having a dialogue about who this person could be. The last people, the last kind of people who would ever believe that Jesus was God were the first century Jews. What power could have gotten them to believe in him the way that they did? Thomas Aquinas, he's quoted saying this, if Jesus didn't really live, then the only alternative is to believe that an even greater miracle happened, the conversion of one half of the Roman world and their transformation into unselfishness and new heights of holiness, all by the biggest lie in human history. He can't be a legend. He can't be a good man or a good teacher. It's completely improbable that he was a deceiver or that he was a madman. So where does that leave us? Where does that leave us? If you get rid of your bias against the supernatural, the possible of the supernatural, if you get rid of your bias against the miraculous, it might be hard to believe what he said, but it's even harder to get out from under it. You have to take it at face value. The theories that you have to adhere to in order to get away from him, they're baseless and they're all full of holes. If you're going to study this with integrity, intellectual integrity, you're going to find that any other option, it's completely full of holes. And as a result, you have to believe that it's true. That it's true. And let me just tell you how you can kind of know if you come to realize some of these things are true. You really haven't met the real Jesus unless your reaction has been somewhat extreme. What do I mean by that? Well, either you have to hate him because of all the things that he said, or you've got to fear him and think that he's the most dangerous person to ever live, or your response is that you have to love him with all that you are. And these are the only options that you have because of his claims. If Jesus is who he said that he is, it is great news. What it means is that morality and goodness, that's not the way. That's not the way to come to God. You know, Buddha, he said, just follow my teaching. It'll show you the way. Jesus says, look to me. I am the way. All of my teaching, it points to me. I'm the one you follow. You will never be moral enough to reach God. I came to die in your place and to take your punishment for sin, for your sins against God. See, the good news is that Jesus is God who has come to you. It's not about you trying to go and get to God. Jesus has come to you, and some of you, you need to look further into this. And as we close, I just want you to think about maybe how you need to respond. Do you know why Easter matters so much? Why, if you come and you see that people in church, they're singing at the top of their lungs, and you know, some people, they dress up in suits and they come up front with a tie and everything. Why do people rejoice and enjoy Easter? The reason why Easter matters so much is this, because if it's true, your past can be forgiven. The things that you did, the things that you know you feel a guilt over, the things you know that are sort of written on your sort of unwritten ledger of your conscience, your past can be forgiven. Jesus claimed to be able to forgive you of your sins, and he promises to do it if you just follow, you believe in him. If it's true, you have help in all of your present circumstances. It means that you're never going to be alone, even though you're still going to go through hard times. Jesus never promises Christians easier lives. I'm sorry, if anything, it's probably a little harder. But he promises that he will never leave you or forsake you. See, Easter matters because you will have help in your present circumstances. And Easter matters because what it means is that your future is secure. That you know that you have an eternal home in heaven. Jesus promised, he says, I go away to prepare a place for you. If it wasn't so, I wouldn't tell you that. Because I'm not going to lie to you. See, what Jesus wants you to do if you've never done it, since we're talking about Easter and maybe you have Easter baskets at home, see, this is what Jesus wants you to do. He wants you to put all of your eggs into the Easter basket. To the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Because everything he said, it's true. And everyone's eternity depends on their answer to who is this Jesus? And my prayer for you is that you come to realize who the real Jesus is. Would you pray with me as we close today our Easter services? Heavenly Father, as we are faced with five different options about Jesus, it's impossible that he was a legend. It's impossible that he was just a good teacher or a good man. It's highly improbable. I would even say impossible that he was a liar or that he was a lunatic. And that only gives us the one option, that everything that you tell us, that it's true. And that Jesus came to save sinners like me, like all of us. And I'm so thankful that you have taught us this, that you tell us this. And I pray for the man and the woman today that might be searching, they might be grasping, trying to figure out, okay, what do I believe about Jesus? What is it going to matter in my life today and my life tomorrow? And I just ask that you would help those who might be skeptical, might be struggling, may have never really thought about it much, that they would start to look into the details of the accounts of Jesus and what he said, because their lives will be transformed. I pray that you would change them. I pray that they would come to the point, even today, to say, Lord, I believe. Jesus, I believe that what you did for me when you died on a cross is that you came to save me of my sins. And I want to trust you today. In fact, today I just turn to you and I pray and I say, Lord, I do trust you. Will you please cleanse me of my sins? Will you give me a home with you in heaven when you help me to live tomorrow new, in a new way, because of your goodness to me? Heavenly Father, would you make people new even today?
that today they might say, yeah, this is the day they finally released their hold on their life and they gave it over to you. But today, most of all, we give you thanks and we give you praise for what you have done for us on the cross and with the empty tomb. And we thank you for new life. And with that, we all together say, amen. Thank you all for coming. Happy Easter. Can't get away without saying this. He is risen.
He is risen.
Have a wonderful, wonderful day. Hope to see you again next week.